everyone. Welcome to our podcast discussing the ongoing issues surrounding First Nations child and family welfare and social services. As we are recording in the unceded territories of the Algonquin people, we would first like to start off with an acknowledgement. We pay respects to the Algonquin people who are the traditional guardians of this land. We acknowledge their long-standing relation with this territory, which remains unceded. We pay respects to all Indigenous people in this region from all nations across Canada who call Ottawa home. We acknowledge the traditional knowledge keepers, both young and old, and we honor their courageous leaders, past, present, and future. We will begin the podcast by introducing the topic to you, our listeners. After our brief introduction, you will hear our group member Matama ask questions to our guest speaker, Law Professor Naomi Metallic from the University of Dalhousie. And we will conclude this podcast with a discussion amongst ourselves regarding the social, legal, and political aspects surrounding the ongoing legal matters that the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society is fighting for. So it's no surprise to anyone in particular that the relationship between Indigenous peoples and the Canadian government, both past and present, remains deeply layered in a controversial situation. While many within the general populace have become cognizant in recent years of the injustices and the maltreatment Indigenous peoples have been facing and preaching about for many years, there's still much work to be done. One of these areas falls within the realm of child and family welfare and social services within First Nations communities. The Joint National Policy Review of 2000 found that there was a disparity of 22% on reserves compared to those same services off reserve. The 2005 one-day report of the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society found that there was an approximately $110 million in shortfall per year in child welfare funding, while at the same time, 1 in 10 status Indigenous children were in care, despite First Nations Child and Family Services agencies being underfunded in nearly all aspects. The First Nations Canadian Incident Study of Reported Child Abuse and Neglect in 2019 reported that First Nations children, despite making up only 7.7% of the child population of Canada, made up nearly 20% of all child maltreatment-related investigations of 2019, at a rate of 151 per 1,000 for Indigenous children, compared to 42 per 1,000 for non-Indigenous children. And now to speak more on the FNCFCS, I'll hand it over to Sophia.
Okay, thank you, Brody. So our first question is, what is FNCFCS? So it's an acronym for First Nations Child and Family Caring Society. It's a nonprofit which is goal-oriented towards the safety and ensuring the overall well-being of the First Nations youth and their family. So this was originally built back in 1998 by First Nations Child and Family Services leaders with the end goal to create an overall network and a sense of community amongst First Nations child and family in Canada. So it originated in the Squamish First Nation when agencies had all agreed on supporting this nonprofit with research policy, professional development, and overall networking to support First Nations Child and Family Services. So FNCFCS has reached this goal in many ways over the past few years, mainly through education initiatives, public policy campaigns, and giving resources to support these communities. An important note is that cultural equity is a huge factor of this nonprofit, and this essentially supports First Nation children and their families to feel safe in the home they grew up in, supported, and overall not alone. This helps youth to celebrate their language and understand their history, essentially to be proud of who they are. So a couple of things that they have worked on over the past few years and the cases and a little rundown of the cases is working to expand a reconciliation history project to include new and learning opportunities for non-Indigenous people, such as history of inequity in time. You can see this in downtown Ottawa. A couple events that they've hosted that have had a huge turnout. The first one is their annual Have a Heart Day, which usually has a turnout of around 500 students coming from 40 schools. This project has the goal to bring Canadians together to ensure the safety of First Nations children and their families in ways such as getting a good education and having a lot of mental health services. And one last big project that they just recently started up on was Touchstones for Hope, which is a reconciliation movement to encourage youth and children to participate in reconciling activities, which helps create and maintain relationships between non-Indigenous and Indigenous peoples. So now the big question as to how this relates to Canadian reserves specifically. Back in 2017, Indigenous Awareness Canada posted an article stating that there's no funding for vocational training in secondary schools on reserves. There's no funding for extracurriculars and recreation activities on reserves. And the Aboriginal student dropout rate nationally before grade 12 is currently at 51%. It is known as Canada's Indigenous education crisis. leading back to the main purpose of FCS to promote education, mental health services, and overall make First Nations children and youth proud of who they are. So a couple cases that they've dealt with since 2016 have helped them move forward and move closer to their goal of supporting First Nations children and family to receiving better education, more resources for the community, and to make First Nations children and family feel at home and safe. Okay, so one of these cases is the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal, which issued 12 procedural and non-compliance orders since the 2016 landmark ruling, four of which were issued in 2019 to 2020 alone. In September 2019, the tribunal ruled that First Nations children and their families would receive the maximum compensation allowed through the Canadian Human Rights Act, surrounding around $40,000, finding that Canada has been, quote unquote, willfully and recklessly discriminating against First Nations children. Over 691,000 services and products were provided to First Nations children as a result of Jordan's principle and the May 2017 non-compliance order. And now to talk to you more about Jordan's principle, here is Gabrielle.
Thank you, Sophia. Before I begin to discuss some of the legal events that have taken place regarding Jordan's principle, I would like to give a brief background statement on Jordan's principle itself. Jordan's principle is a child-first principle intended to ensure that First Nation children do not experience denials, delays, or disruptions of services ordinarily available to other children due to jurisdictional disputes. It is named in honor of Jordan Revere Anderson, a young boy from Norway House Cree Nation in Manitoba. After Notion 296 in 2007, the Assembly of First Nation and the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society of Canada filed a complaint before the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal, the CHRT, which is a legal institution that considers alleged branches of the Canadian Human Rights Act. In November 2010, Minister Durkan from the Department of AANDC, formerly known as the Indian Affairs and Northern Development, testified before the Aboriginal Affairs Parliament Committee with regards to First Nation Children and Family Services. A Jordan's Principle debriefing document prepared for the occasion states that the AANDC did not identify any jurisdictional disputes involving the federal and provincial governments. The federal government's lack of public education on how to report a Jordan's Principle case and the process used to review them likely explains why government officials were able to testify that no jurisdictional disputes had come to their attention. The Supreme Court of Nova Scotia ruled that the secrets of the external circumstances clause was inconsistent with law, putting it simply that the court believed that funding levels should be based on a person's needs instead of the amount set out in the policy document. In testimony before the Human Rights Tribunal, the director of the First Nations Child Welfare Agency recalled a case in which agency staff conducted a community fundraising campaign to finance the purchase of a wheelchair for a paraplegic child in and out of home care. Health Canada denied the request for funds to purchase the wheelchair, as appealing this decision could be a lengthy process involving three levels of review. The agency deemed that the fundraising was the only feasible option to provide the child with what he required. It is undoubtedly that a jurisdictional dispute exists in any situation in which ambiguity regarding responsibility for service funding provision results in denial, delay, or disruption of services. It also exists whenever the resources provided by one's government or department are insufficient to enable another government or department to provide what they need to. In Jordan's case, tragic delays in services and resulted from a jurisdictional dispute. Provincial and federal government departments disagreed on who should bear financial responsibility for Jordan's in-home care. A jurisdictional dispute of this kind could potentially arise in any situation involving unclear declaration of the jurisdictional authority of two or more governments or government departments. In 2016, the CHRT determined that the Government of Canada approach to services for First Nations children was discriminatory. In May 2017, the CHRT ordered that the needs of each individual child must be considered to ensure the following is taken under account under Jordan's principle, providing cultural appropriate services, safeguarding the best interests for the child. On September 6, 2019, the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal released a decision related to compensation for certain individuals under Jordan's principle. As of July 17, 2020, the First Nations child eligible to receive services through Jordan's principle now included those who were recognized by their nation and those with a parent who has status, and all persons eligible under Section 3 are immediately eligible for Jordan's principle. on January 4th, 2022, Ottawa Traditional Algonquin Territory and Ontario Indigenous Service Canada announced that the agreement in Jordan's principle has been reached on a global resolution related to compensation for those harmed by discriminatory underfunding of First Nation and Family Services and to achieve long-term reform for the First Nations Child and Family Service Program and Jordan's principle to ensure that no child feels discrimination again. The agreement in principle includes key aspects such as $20 billion in compensation for First Nations children on reserves and in the Yukon who were removed from their homes between April 1, 1991 and March 31, 2022, and for their parents and caregivers. Also, approximately $20 billion over 5 years for long-term reform for the First Nations Child and Family Services Program to ensure that the discrimination found by the CHRT never repeats itself. Currently, Jordan's principle continues to evolve through the legal proceedings of the CHRT.
Now that we've given you some background information on the topic, we will now hear from our guest speaker, Naomi Metallic. She is a professor of law and a chancellor's chair in Aboriginal law and policy at the University of Dalhousie. She is a member of the Listigouge Mi'kmaq First Nation, which is located on the Gaspé coast of Quebec. We are very lucky to have spoken with her and hope you will enjoy some of the insights and comments she gave us.
To give our listeners a little bit more information about yourself and your background, the first question I wanted to ask you is, what drove you to the practice of Aboriginal law?
Well, let's see. I actually didn't intend to become a lawyer when I went to university, and I didn't know any lawyers in my family, or I think there was a few from my community. I'm from a First Nations community situated on the border of Quebec and New Brunswick. I think I went to university thinking I might become a journalist or a writer. I'm a good writer. And anyway, I ended up taking a variety of courses in English and in philosophy, history, and some of the history classes really got me really actively reading. And I was taking philosophy courses too at the time, and philosophy of law and ethics. And so all of these ideas were in my head and sort of becoming, I think, more awakened to law and policy and the impacts that that had on Indigenous people and the role somebody might have. And then I was also encouraged at that point by an Indigenous professor that I knew to consider going to law school. And we have a program at the law school at Dalhousie in Halifax that has dedicated seats for Black and Mi'kmaq students, six and six each year. And so I was intrigued by that they had that. And so anyway, I applied. It was the only law school I applied to and got accepted. And the rest is history, as they say. But actually, there's more to it. But along the way, and I was doing a lot of this sort of by the seat of my pants. I was 20, 21, and I really didn't know what I was going to do. But along the way, there were signposts or things that sort of kept on pushing me in the direction that I have found myself in. And yeah, so ended up working at a firm that does Aboriginal and treaty rights work for groups in the Maritimes. And so really became much more active in that. Yeah. And I guess the last point I'll say on that is that what drove me from practice to academia was a case that was about social assistance, so welfare services on reserves. I was working with communities in 2011 when the Harper government cut rates for welfare on reserves. And it's very similar to some of the issues going on in the Caring Society case. And the Caring Society case was kind of going on at that time. And that's when I started to connect with Cindy Blackstock. But that just really opened my eyes to the issues around systemic underfunding of services on reserve and how problematic it was. And that there was nothing really much written on it. Some work in Cindy and the social work field, but not a lot in law, and there really needed to be. And so I was like, you know, maybe I can have a more effect if I'm actually speaking and writing about this in academia, as opposed to just fighting one single case at a time. So that was a huge driver for me to come to academia. And here we are.
And we are very happy for it. So then, are there any projects that you're working on currently that you'd be able to shed some light about?
Well, I am representing the Caring Society in going. I'm co-counsel on the C92 reference. That's, you know, so that was the legislation that was passed on child and family services by the federal government in part as a response to the Caring Society case that got challenged by Quebec. So that went to the Quebec Court of Appeal. I was there and argued on behalf of the Caring Society. And Since we're going to the Supreme Court of Canada, I guess I'll be going there too to argue as well. I have various other sort of projects. I don't know if they're all I can really talk about, but let's just say that I am in the army of Cindy. If you see up there, I guess you won't be able to see in your podcast, but I will describe that up on my mantle and back of me, there is a bear. And when you are in the army of Cindy, you are gifted a bear. So your professor might have one as well. I'm not sure. And so you have to name him. He's Spirit Bear's cousin. And you've got certain obligations. And woe betide you if you happen to be on a call with Cindy and you forget your bear, because you will be bear shamed and she will ask you where your bear is and why the bear is not in the shot. But no, I love her and she does amazing work and she has selflessly given herself up, you know, really for this cause and keeps pushing it. And it's amazing. So I'm happy to help her. I'm just joking about the bear. I mean, it's true, but you know, I love her and will do whatever she asks, even when I'm really busy, because I think that's all important. So I'm doing some other work on some other projects related to that. Beyond that, I am working on the issue of C92. Generally, I give advice and support to communities. I get questions all the time. I write articles about that to a bunch of other people. I educate judges and lawyers on child welfare and C92. I have projects going on social assistance and trying to help communities develop a system that is more culturally appropriate. I do work on Indigenous policing that also has issues around systemic underfunding. So yeah, I could list you off all the things that I do in my spare time.
That was very informative. And honestly, not really important, but I do just imagine when you're getting on meetings with Cindy Blackstock that you'll play a little game of where's the spirit bear?
Yep, she'll ask where my bear is. And I'm not the only, I've talked to other people who work a lot with Cindy and she thinks, you know, it's important to her. So there he is. Mween Edge is up there and he's always there now.
That's lovely. I have just noticed him. As we're familiar with, the Crown has taken a sort of stewardship role over First Nations communities in Canada. And some of the obligations that the Crown has to First Nations communities include aiding in the funding of transportation and water infrastructure, health and education services, housing and child and family welfare. Yet one of the many controversies surrounding the Crown's treatment of First Nations communities relates to the underfunding of child welfare services on reserves. So my question to you is there a legal basis for Canada to provide these social services and protections to First Nation communities?
Well, let's start with a question, sort of a more of a rhetorical question back, which is the provinces also provide all of these, the same services that you listed off to their citizens, right? In Canada, since about the 1950s, post-World War II, we have developed this idea of a social safety net, right? So provinces provide child services. They do provide services for housing, education. So the first thing I want by sort of posing that sort of question is to get at potentially a concern that I would have that question, not suggesting you were suggesting this, but I know that there are people who think that these are all special rights to Indigenous people. These are rights that every citizen of Canada has. Let's start off with that as our first premise. But the issue in Canada is that we have a system of government where we both have federal and provincial jurisdiction. And most of the services you listed off are ones that are usually regarded as the responsibility of provincial governments to offer to their citizens. However, because our constitution gives jurisdiction over the federal government, over what I'm saying in quotes is Indians and lands reserved for the Indians, there has always been, or very much since the creation of this social safety net, a debate between the federal and provincial governments about who has jurisdiction and responsibility to provide these same services that we provide to everybody else, to First Nations. And usually when we have constitutional disputes, it's because both of them want power. But this is one area where neither of them want responsibility or power. So they have constantly said to each other, no, it's your responsibility. No, it's yours. And what happens to Indigenous peoples in the meantime is that their issues, these needs for these services, which are basic essential services that people need to live, have been ignored for decades. And if not ignored, provided in a way that was always less. than what other citizens have received. And that is, in fact, what was found in the Caring Society case, which found that the government had of Canada had taken on itself to provide these services to First Nations, but was doing it in a way that was lesser than what all the other citizens in Canada were receiving. So, you know, that question of what is the basis for that? I mean, all governments in Canada provide these basic essential services, and we could have an interesting debate about whether those are actually charter rights that all of us have, or basic fundamental rights to necessities. Still a little bit of an uncertain question. But when it comes to First Nations people, we certainly have, you know, human rights to be able to have the same levels of services as other people. And that Caring Society case, in fact, said that, you know, meeting equality for Indigenous peoples, what it called substantive equality, actually doesn't just mean mirroring whatever the provinces give to their citizens. It's actually meeting the needs of Indigenous peoples based on their historic, geographic, and other circumstances that they might have. But there's other questions too. In Caring Society, the tribunal did suggest too that there is a fiduciary duty. This federal government also has fiduciary obligations to Indigenous peoples. How that has sort of been interpreted by the courts is still a little bit gray, but I mean, there's arguments too that part of this includes fiduciary duties, also that Canada's obligations come from treaty obligations as well. And another sort of legal element we could bring into this is the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which is now recognized in Canadian law and says that it's about recognizing the fundamental rights, human rights of Indigenous peoples. And there are provisions in there that speak about the needs for socioeconomic rights and a variety of other things. So there is a lot of layers to this legal puzzle. And the government kind of argued this a lot for a long time, which is like, oh, we just do it out of the goodness of our heart. We have no real obligation to do this, right? So my answer was sort of getting at, like, there's a lot more to it.
You touched upon the current case, the Caring Society's case against the government of Canada, mm-hmm. and the ongoing legal disputes there. So in 2016, the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal had ruled that Canada's application of Jordan's principle was really narrow and discriminatory to the extent that even Jordan himself may not have been able to access these services. Since that ruling, there had been 21 additional orders for the government to comply with the tribunal's ruling. And since then, the government has filed judicial reviews challenging those rulings. And so what I wanted to ask you is that, what do you think is the most likely scenario to play out from these legal disputes?
Currently, the only outstanding judicial review and there was only a couple that got JR in our legal speak, but the two sort of bigger outstanding ones was the one interpreting Jordan's principle to expand beyond First Nations with status. That got paired with also the ruling on compensation, right? So Canada did challenge the ruling from the tribunal that ruled individual compensation to kids that had been denied Jordan's principle, as well as those that had been discriminated against for being taken into care on account of the underfunding as well. You know, that the 2016 decision is also about the chronic underfunding as well as Jordan's principle. They're sort of two separate issues, both found to have been violations of human rights. So what happened is that those two issues, the individual compensation plus the Indian Act status issue, who's entitled to Jordan's principle, did get JR, did go to the federal court, and we get a decision from Justice Favelle in the summer, and then Canada was appealing that. So, and they did appeal, but the parties have been negotiating to address that. So Canada calls it something like a protective appeal, but they're not actually pursuing the appeal right now. It's on hold effectively while they're negotiating that. And I think it was right after Christmas, or around that time, the parties announced an agreement in principle of a $40 billion settlement, 20 of that earmarked for the individual compensation claims, and then the other 20 to address long-standing or long-term reform of child welfare services. And so my understanding is that's just an agreement in principle. There's nothing. So they have to work out a bunch of details, and they have given themselves a timeline of this summer to work out those the remaining details to make that agreement in principle stick. So that's where that is. So I don't believe that there are any other sort of outstanding JRs, but yeah, there's still a lot to figure out. And, you know, there's a great little newsletter or statement from the Caring Society on their website that says, like, guys, don't get too excited yet. It's just an agreement in principle, and there's a lot to figure out. And there's a lot that needs to be addressed by Canada in order to make this work. And I think the hard work is on the long-term reform part of it. And kind of going back to my earlier statement about the need for more accountability, I do think finding more mechanisms to ensure that Canada remains accountable to respect Jordan's principle, as well as substantive equality of Indigenous children and families, is really key, because the tribunal has played an indispensable role in ensuring accountability. But at some point, it's not going to have jurisdiction over the case. Like, the case has to end eventually. It's amazing that they've held jurisdiction this long. But after that, we're still going to need something to hold Canada accountable. And as much as I would love to believe that Canada is just going to do the right thing and is going to be all, it's all going to be great, I really feel that we do need more accountability mechanisms to really hold them to that. Because even when people don't mean to, sometimes they really don't know how to effectively address human rights, especially sometimes in a bureaucratic governance context.
Sure. Thank you so much. That was a very informative answer, and I definitely learned a lot that I didn't know beforehand. The final question that I have for you before we wrap things up is, for you personally, how can law, both the profession and the academic discipline, be used in the reconciliation effort and improve the lives of First Nations communities and other Indigenous peoples in Canada?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be doing any of this if I didn't believe that there was a real important role that law can play. I think at the same time, though, I mean, nothing is ever a panacea, right? Nothing is ever perfect, because law is a human construct and humans are imperfect, and people try, people fail. And I think it's just people that need to be, you know, learn from their mistakes and move things forward. But yeah, no, I certainly think, I mean, law has been a terrible tool of oppression at times, right? There's no question of that. I mean, we can give the Indian Act as an example and various other things, but law can also be a wonderful tool of emancipation, right? It's how you use it. And being imaginative and creative with the law is something that is possible. That's one thing I really try to impart upon my students. A lot of students come to law school thinking that the law is very black and white, and that law school will simply be an exercise of memorizing black and white rules. It is anything but that. Again, it is always something that moves and changes and can represent the best of us. But right, you got to work at that. You know, our constitution is a living tree, and things like equality rights and human rights, those are all things that we can push for different interpretations of, because often there are interpretations. Yes, there's, you know, written laws, statutes, but even those things have to be interpreted. And so I always try to really give my students tools to be able to marshal the law in order to use it to advance the positions of Indigenous people or whatever group that they're trying to, you know, if they're passionate about that, working towards advancing their well-being. So I think it's possible. And actually, yeah, I think there's a fair degree of creativity that goes into the law. I remember when I told you how I wanted, when I came to university, that I was thinking of writing, and I was very good at creative writing, and my English teacher in high school loved me, and we're still in touch, but she was disappointed when she found out that I was going to go into law school, because she thought that it was a terribly dry, unimaginative, and, you know, restrictive profession. And I was like, no, not at all. In fact, we need more people who are going to come in and be imaginative and creative and thinking about the law and pushing the law, because again, it's a human construct. It can always move and change. And I think the law teaches us not to just accept no for an answer. Like, that's just how it is. That's the law. Like, why is it that case that it's this way and always pushing? So that's sort of how I see the law and how I use it in my work.
Just for our listeners out there, is there anything that they can do to ensure that anyone in Canada, First Nations, and any other citizens of Canada that are able to do to ensure that the government's being held accountable for this?
Yeah, I mean, we all have some degree of power, right? That's by raising awareness. But I think we can also ask questions of our governments, right, about what they're doing. especially around this, you will see Cindy and the Caring Society, Cindy Blackstaff, being more active, especially as I think towards, you know, they're having more discussions on what long-term reform looks like. There will be ideas that are going to be floated and discussed. And one would hope that governments are going to act on this, but it may take pressure from the public. And that is something that I think Caring Society and its I Am a Witness and its Jordan's Principle and Shannon's Dream campaigns have been really effective at, is bringing a lot of the public, lots of them kids, right, along with them, who are asking questions and pressuring their governments to, you know, why aren't you acting on this? Why are you still allowing this discrimination to happen in 2020, 21, 22? I think those are ways, right? Is educating yourself on that, following, you know, the Caring Society and finding out what they're asking for. And then, you know, if you're in agreement with that, pressuring your governments to move on that.
Sure, yes. That is very informative. And I honestly hope that we are able to ensure that these accountability mechanisms are put in place. Thank you so much for that. Those are all the questions that I have for you. It's definitely been really informative, and I think I got more out of it than honestly thought that I would get.
Now that we've heard some wonderful insight from Naomi, we will transition to a discussion amongst ourselves about her comments. I will be going over some of our answers point by point and further expanding upon what great topics and insights that she gave us. Naomi really points out in this question that the current kind of legal battle is still very much an ongoing issue, and that even though the agreement in principle that she mentions, which is supposedly promising $40 billion for Indigenous health, is still very much in its kind of preliminary stages. So that really means that this is even pointed out on the First Nations Caring Society's website, is that it's still very much an ongoing battle, which I think is even more reason for people to get themselves aware about the situation and continuing to apply pressure in this scenario, which is something we can all do. And I think it's a really good example that you have to make sure that the, you know, action or the words that governments or agencies like to propose, you have to make sure to hold them accountable so that their words just don't become words, they become actions. Who else would like to comment on this?
I guess I could jump in from there. And one thing that I just wanted to touch upon was just the significance of this $40 billion settlement that has an agreement in principle right now, and just how significant that would be, not only for this case, but just for Canada's reconciliation with Indigenous peoples. And specifically, on the 21st of March, the Prime Minister issued a statement in light of the International Day for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. And so as part of his comments, he wanted to reassure Canadians that the government is doing what they can to build a more inclusive, equal, and fair society for everybody. Particularly, he did touch upon what the government was doing to ensure that the systemic inequalities and the racial discrimination against Indigenous peoples is addressed by the government. And I think the $40 billion settlement is just a key step in that direction, not only for being able to compensate the individuals who have been harmed thus far, and for building a better system to ensure that First Nations children and family are able to access these services in the future. I think the $40 billion settlement is just a step in the right direction, because it really does show to Indigenous peoples in Canada, as well as other Canadians and the whole world, that Canada is making good on its image of being a bastion of human rights, if it's able to right historical wrongs that it's been able to do to Indigenous peoples. And I sincerely hope that there is an agreement that can come from this that can see restitution for Indigenous peoples.
Can I step in?
Yeah, go ahead.
I 100% agree with you that it definitely is the right step towards reconciliation and making things better in a way. However, I agree with what Naomi had said about not getting too excited yet, because the stage that it is in right now, it has not been like fully developed. They have not fully, acted on the agreement. So I feel like once they have begun putting action to their words, that is when we can fully say, yes, they're making changes. Yes, this is happening, because as of now, it's simply words on a paper and they have not fully started taking action as of yet.
Just to bounce off what Gabrielle said, quoting Naomi, actually, she said, it is still just an agreement in principle, and there is still much more to be adjusted. However, I do agree it is a step forward for Canada into the Reconciliation Act. One thing that Naomi had also mentioned is that not many people know about it. Not many people, not many lawyers or political leaders know about the suit going on. And without this knowledge, the people who it's meant for are not able to utilize it in the way that it is meant to be.
So this next question now really points out that there have been many Indigenous-led campaigns that have been getting people involved in raising awareness, as well as asking questions and holding the government accountable and maintaining pressure. Because as she points out, that the tribunal in this legal case, which has been acting as a accountability mechanism, won't be there forever, since the case will eventually end, and that these kind of civic groups are really, really great way as an additional modifier for holding the government accountable, and also as a replacement once that tribunal kind of fades away. And that she really posits for the listeners that if you want to know more about this topic, she really greatly encourages finding more about the First Nations Caring Society, what they stand for and what they're asking for. And if you agree on it, then taking the steps forward to kind of pressure the government to move on these various demands. So I'll hand it over to the rest of my group.
Not much to say. I think Naomi definitely hit the nail on the head with her recommendations here. So keeping up with the activities of the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society, because they do keep their website up to date and it's really easy to follow, not only with the updates on the court case, but any other activities that they're doing. I think something else that would be a little bit helpful for everybody to do, you could just reach out to your local MP. And eventually, if enough of us reach our local MPs, it does suggest to the people who are making the decisions that the Canadian population is keeping the pressure on the government to act. We all care about the topic and we just want to see this resolution. And I think that's just a great way to get ordinary people involved wherever they are. So just like writing an email, sending in a message, calling the office, just one of those.
I 100% agree. And what I would like to touch on is that I personally believe that educating yourself is the best way to keep the government accountable for young children and for old children. It doesn't matter how old you are, what part of Canada you're from, being educated on the topic will help a lot. And some questions I feel like should be asked is, what is the government doing? What is their legal roles? Updates on Jordan's principle? What are the long-term reforms of the First Nation children and service and family services? And who is covered by Jordan's principle? I think those are some really important questions that should be asked once you're able to educate yourself on the situation at hand.
Yeah, I definitely see that. One thing I do want to touch on is Naomi said to apply pressure and ask questions of the government, especially when she referred to the children. First Nations Child and Family Caring Society mentioned on their website that they did do their annual Have a Hard Day event, which usually has a turnout of around 500 students. And from a personal experience, why this is so important is because back when I was in high school in Ontario, they had switched the grade 11 English curriculum from reading Shakespeare into Indigenous literature. And the book that we had read that I remember specifically is 21 Things You Didn't Know About the Indian Act by Bob Joseph. And it had touched on exactly what you think, 21 things you didn't know, in hopes to move forward in reconciliating. And these type of initiatives created conversations among students and children. And when you're giving this to the youth, they're going out into the world post-secondary, they're pursuing this with the knowledge that they're given. It's not hidden away. It's not touched upon. Like Naomi said, from her own personal experience, she started reading into this stuff, and that led her to go into Indigenous law and thus make a change.
To kind of jump back in, I wanted to say that with the whole youth being the most important demographic nowadays, with technology, information is so easily transferred, especially between young kids and young adults. And if the right platform is giving the right information, I believe that everyone can be properly informed and educated on Jordan's principle and the legal aspects and who's able to be covered under Jordan's principle and all of the important things.
Yeah, I definitely think that's a very important aspect, especially with media, because nowadays that is the quickest way to get someone's attention. And we're seeing youth being educated like across medium with infographics, conversations being held. And when this information is being exposed to the youth in ways that suits them, you know, on social media, conversations between friends, that is what initially is leading them to go on their own and make these choices to learn and educate themselves.
Yeah, just to jump back in, touching upon what both of you said about using media as a platform to kind of get the word out. The First Nations Child and Family Caring Society does have a Facebook and Twitter page. But one thing that was on my mind is you guys were saying that I was wondering if Instagram would be another medium that can be used. Because I know with social media being as widespread as it is, having so much content online, we don't really have as high of an attention span to a lot of details. So like, I was wondering if utilizing something like Instagram posts or reels, just with little tidbits of information of things that are either going on or things that the Caring Society wants to put forward to the public, would be another medium that could be used to make sure that information is out and people are being educated.
I think across all social media platforms, really, like, especially with the pandemic going on and everyone being isolated, that was really our primary form of communication, right? Was through Instagram, through Snapchat, at least for the youth. So just having it there on platforms where everyone is, where there's a large population on and seeing it, it makes an impact. I definitely do think that targeting the youth in terms of understanding that they're going to go out in the world, they're the future, and having, I would definitely say that past generations, they did not have as much like resource to this knowledge, right? It wasn't taught in schools. There wasn't many books written about it. So it's very different for this generation, I would say.
Yeah, I definitely think it's a generational thing, because our generation has access to the internet and has access to all these types of social media platforms. And it's like, it's not necessarily like different groups of youth. It's like this generation is so equipped to be able to make changes in the world that if someone gives us the correct information, we're able to do that. Has been seen like previously with other big movements that have happened when they blow up on social media and people have never even heard of it, know about it. Young kids, older kids, adults, like old people, everybody knows about it. So I feel like using social media with this specific demographic of young people is the best way to go about it for education wise, to get the proper reaction that they would want, the exposure.
Oh yeah, no, for sure. And one thing that I'm just thinking about now is when Matama had mentioned sending an email or a letter or a phone call to your MP, there's been many cases in that where a lot of youth have taken it upon themselves to go do that. So already right there, that's an amazing initiative.
Great discussion. Naomi's path to law was not the most orthodox, as she's pointed out, as she originally planned to go to post-secondary to become a journalist, and was really into creative writing, and then shifted to law after finding out that Dalhousie has dedicated positions within its law school for Black and Indigenous students, and that she was really surprised in the creativity and flexibility that law actually provided, rather than the rigidity that she was expecting initially. So does anyone have any comments to share with us?
I just want to touch on her path into Indigenous law, how it was influenced by knowledge being given to her. And we can definitely reflect that onto the question that was just given about accountability mechanisms. And it really just goes to show how much putting this knowledge out there, teaching this knowledge can influence someone, right? Because that led her to go into Indigenous law, help fighting these big cases, help making a difference for reconciliation. But just in terms of being in Indigenous law, she had mentioned a couple of times that you're going up against the biggest law firm in the country. I so much respect for that. It's such a difficult aspect of law, Indigenous law, because this stuff has been going on for years. Like, It's an ongoing fighting case. She mentioned that about the case that we were talking about, that at some point this case has to end. And the question as to what comes after that will come up. And although we want to rely on the Canadian government to do the right thing, somebody still has to keep them accountable. And it's this continuous ongoing fight that going into Indigenous law is very important. Educating people on Indigenous law, it can definitely influence people into that direction, which is what we need. We need lawyers in that field.
To touch on her wanting to be a lawyer, I personally want to be a lawyer after I finish my undergrad and graduate studies. And for me, unlike her, for me, I've always wanted to be a lawyer. But once I've come to university, I feel like my head has kind of been swayed in different professions. And I understand when she was talking about how she wanted to be a journalist and then she ended up doing law.
Yeah, I 100% agree with Sophia. And the only thing I just wanted to say was her pathway into Indigenous law, initially not having plans to go into the field, but then realizing that's something that she wanted to do. I think that's just a powerful example to show that it is possible for ordinary people to take measures for how they want to be involved, that some would adopt career paths that are specifically oriented towards the fight. And I can definitely respect that. It's regardless of whether or not you want to go to law, I'm sure there are other professions that you could go to if you wanted to specifically dedicate yourself to this fight. And even if not, it's still good to know that there are other resources that people in other professions who don't necessarily have the resources to devote so much of their time and their career towards it, but still want to be able to lend a helping hand. I think the most important thing in that instance is just being willing to contribute in whatever way possible.
In this last question, Naomi points out that law can be used as a new tool of emancipation in these kind of modern times, whereas in the past it was used as a terrible tool of oppression, and that's kind of related to the various legal methods that were used by the government of Canada to basically control Indigenous people, chiefly being the Indian Act, as well as many others. So her utilizing this new tool as something that she truly believes in can bring about change is really refreshing to see. So does anyone have any thoughts on this?
I think the only thing that I can say is that I think the decisions from the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal, as well as the Government of Canada's adopting of UNDRIP into Canadian law, is just an indicator of how law could be used to serve as kind of the backbone for the government to act and provide services for Indigenous peoples.
So a couple of things that Naomi has said herself that I found very interesting on my own part. She mentioned that law is a human construct and it isn't black and white, but creative and imaginative. And I want to push this back and connect it with applying pressure to the government. There's ways that we can utilize the law in terms of moving forward with reconciliating. And she had mentioned that in students in law school believe that it is very black and white, which is clear it is not. And the understanding of that you can be creative and imaginative with it, I think pushes law in a very different direction. Because me personally, I'm not really into the law sector. I don't know much about it. So I did believe that it is black and white. There is right and wrong, and that there isn't a gray area. So I think also the understanding of this, not only to law students, but the public, that idea that you're able to manipulate this and once again, use it for a tool for emancipation and sort of not being afraid to do it. She mentions that at some point the case will end, but after that, take it from there, like be creative, be imaginative with it, especially coming from the point that First Nations do not have unlimited resources to fight the government of Canada. So the need to, one, go back to, we need more lawyers in Indigenous law, creative minds, understanding that law is not black and white. It steers us in a direction to make a lot of reconciliating acts and just move forward with reconciliating.
Oh yeah, 100%. What I was going to jump into is just something that I found pretty interesting. And she mentioned this in her response to the first question that I asked her. It took me a while to fully comprehend what she just said, but I think what she said about jurisdiction in Canada over providing essential services to Indigenous communities that ties back into what we're talking about, law not being black and white and having a gray area. That serves as a perfect example where you have the provincial governments on the one hand who have jurisdiction over providing basic goods and services to all Canadians in the country. And on the other hand, you have within the Constitution that the federal government is taking on the role, the jurisdiction over all of Indigenous peoples. So the gray area here is just where they kind of overlap, especially in the Caring Society case, where there's been conflict of who has jurisdiction over providing goods and services that the provincial governments provide, but for Indigenous peoples. And with Naomi saying that the federal government has taken on that role to exert jurisdiction over this area, it does show that there is a little bit of a constitutional gray area here. But where I see law being a tool of emancipation is just, it kind of gives us that foundation, kind of like a navigating guide to get us through this gray area. Like with me mentioning before, the adoption of UNDRIP into Canadian law and that recognizing that Indigenous peoples everywhere have human rights. And I think that's honestly just the heart of it when it comes to these legal gray areas, particularly with the Caring Society case. It's just that recognizing that Indigenous peoples in Canada are also people too, and being able to provide these services is just acknowledging that they have human rights, and more so they have the same equal human rights as other Canadians in society. And if the law can help us start from that point, then we can continue being creative in making sure that we are able to navigate these gray areas, and in the end of the day that we are building to what the Prime Minister said we were, which was just a more fair, inclusive, and equal society.
I'm really glad you brought that up, because that takes us back to the statistic that I had mentioned earlier, that in 2017, Indigenous Awareness Canada had stated that the Aboriginal student dropout rate on reserves before grade 12 was at 51%. So it's kind of contradictory in its essence, is that we want to push the reconciliation with First Nations and go deeper into Indigenous law, whereas on reserves, like you said, basic human rights are not being met. So I definitely do think that's very contradictory, very ironic, I'd say.
So we very much thank you, the listeners, for taking out the time of your day to listen to our podcast. We also very much want to thank Naomi Metallic for giving us her wonderful time and insight on the subject. We've truly learned so much from her and hope that she does many great things in the future. Lastly, we wanted to conclude with the idea that this situation is very much an ongoing affair, and we encourage the listeners of this podcast to keep up with ongoing legal matters, not only in developments being talked about in the news, but also those posted on the First Nations Caring Society website. Their social medias, if you're curious, are on Twitter at Caring Society and at Spirit Bear. On Facebook, they are Caring Society, Instagram, Spirit Bear and Friends, and on their very own website at www.firstnationscaringsociety.com. And lastly, we also encourage you to do your own research to get educated on this matter. Firstly, by going to the First Nations Caring Society website, as well as looking into the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal, and also lastly, looking at Jordan's Principle and what it stands for. You can find resources specifically on Jordan's Principle on the First Nations Caring Society website, as well as the website for the Government of Canada on that particular subject. And thank you so much for listening. Where we can share a love.